Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Welcome to episode 12 of The Hi-Lo, the weekly news and pop culture podcast brought to you by Pandora Sykes and Dolly Alderton. This week has been a devastating one, there's no other way to put that. We never thought we'd be bringing you an episode in the wake of a tragic terror attack. In a tale that we are all now very familiar with, on Monday night at an Ariana Grande concert at the Manchester Arena, 22 people were killed by a suicide bomber and 59 injured. At the time of recording, 8 people are still missing, including teenagers Chloe Rutherford, who is 17, and Liam Curry, who is 19.
Obviously, any terrorist attack is always tragic and a desperately awful, sad thing. But I think there's something particularly disturbing and distressing and horrifying about the fact it was at a concert that was predominantly for young girls. Did you read the piece Alexis Petridis, who's the Guardian music critic?
No, I'm familiar, but no, I haven't. I haven't read that.
He read this piece that was very moving, that was coming at the story kind of from a different angle, talking about the horror unfolding in the context of it being a pop concert. And he told a story about when he's got 2 young daughters, and he told a story about taking his daughter to a Jessie J concert, one of her first pop concerts. And he said, you know, that kind of environment represents joy and the forming of a young identity and finding your people. And the closing paragraph, he said, giving people their first taste of freedom and independence, that strikes me as something at the top of the chart of incredible things music can do. It's also something that the kind of people who manipulate others into blowing themselves up in public places hate.
It's undoubtedly a very odd and awful situation for Ariana Grande as well, the pop star who everyone had gathered to see. I quite agree with some of the comments I've seen, which is it's not as awful for her as it is for the families who have lost someone. No one should suggest that.
Certainly, but the weight of guilt must
be. The way she has been inserted into the story, I think she's dealt with it admirably. She tweeted, "Broken from the bottom of my heart, I'm so, so sorry, I don't have words." And she's since been arriving back home, launching herself into the arms of her boyfriend, crying. She's reportedly offered to pay for the victims' funerals. I don't know
has
if that's
really
substantiated, or if any of them are taking her up on it. And then there's been some interesting kind of news shared about celebrities and how they've reacted in the context of doing these big pop concerts, which obviously makes both them and the fans very vulnerable. So Katy Perry and Lorde have not cancelled their UK gigs. They said they're not going to. Justin Bieber is under pressure to cancel his. I don't know why he's under more pressure than them. But there have been some particularly distasteful headlines, I think. So the Evening Standard headline on Tuesday was "Slaughter of Ariana Innocence." And I think the way she was inserted between slaughtered and innocence was just not responsible, if I'm honest. I really, really don't like the way that was billed.
There was a particularly galling and offensive headline on the Mail Online that I just, the minute I saw it, I just came out and I just thought, this is exactly why I don't go on this website anymore. That was an op-ed that said something like, "Ariana Grande's revealing sexualized outfits represent everything Islamists hate."
Well, of course they represent everything that fundamentalists hate, because they also hate people having fun, women making independent choices, socialising, dating, wearing what they want. Like, do you know what I mean? The list goes on.
But to link that as some sort of cause of
blame. What I mean is it's a complete non-starter.
Of course they
hate her outfits. That's nothing new. And whether or not they're sexualised. I don't know if it's difficult. If I saw that headline on a different publication, it wouldn't necessarily hit me in the same way that you reading on the Daily Mail has, because you're right, the revealing, it's shaming, isn't it? Revealing,
that's it.
Sexualized, it's shaming. If it was Ariana Grande's skimpy outfits, enrage Islamists, I don't know if I would find that necessarily offensive because they are skimpy. She's on stage, she's hot, she's a young girl.
I think it's the subtext of
it. Yeah, exactly.
It's coming from the misogynistic recess of the internet that is the Daily Mail.
I mean, I think this has been a really... the aftermath of this story has been interesting in terms of the media. There was a particularly interesting series of tweets that got a huge response on Twitter, and I posted on both my Twitter feed and the Hilo, so do have a read. And it's from a doctor who had previously witnessed a terror attack. She doesn't say which one, and she warned about the media's role in post-traumatic stress disorder. So she's got the handle DrM_79. She tweeted, these were a series of tweets, "When I was caught up in a terrorist incident 4 years ago, the behaviour of UK media made the trauma so much worse. They don't seem to have changed. I've seen journalists from major news organisations outside hospital waiting to interview people leaving, asking witnesses for more and more detail. News organisations need to consider their role in causing post-traumatic stress disorder. There is evidence on this. Part of the trauma is caused in the aftermath by response. In the face of terror, people suffer but are strong. Emergency services and others are incredible. Media could help rather than traumatise." She then goes on to list all the things the media did to her and her family.
Horrific.
To try and get a story after a terrorist attack. "They hacked my Facebook, turned up on my mum's doorstep, repeatedly called and doorstepped her before she knew if I was okay, repeatedly called the emergency number at the hospital where I worked, called elderly relatives who didn't know I was abroad and told them that I had been caught up in a terrorist incident. They repeatedly called a mental health helpline where I volunteered on their emergency number. They used personal Facebook accounts to try and friend me, turned up at my house for days, called my phone so much that I could not access it, meaning I had to turn it off, meaning I couldn't access support from friends and family." I mean, this is horrific, and as a journalist, I'm galled and I'm ashamed to read this. And after I read all that, I saw a tweet from someone who was in Manchester, and it was just a note from a journalist saying, "Sorry to write to you today, but please call me." And then his business card was attached to the note. And the thing is being a journalist like you are, I know that the news desk has a job to do. And I know from experience that the news desk is a highly pressurised dog-eat-dog world. Mm. But Jesus, it's pause for thought, that, isn't it?
I know. I mean, I'm lucky that I've never been coerced into that form of doorstepping or that form of journalism. But I know a lot of my contemporaries have, and I know it really haunts them.
It can be hard to know what to say, leaving the media aside. Certainly, I know that you and I were very careful when we were talking about this today, because the last thing we want to do is to trigger anyone
it's delicate.
Or add further upset. But sometimes it's pretty obvious what not to say. Case in point, Kim Kardashian's tweet. "Concerts are supposed to be a place where you can let loose and have fun," she tweeted. "It's so scary not to feel safe in this world. Ariana Grande, I love you." Quite right, concerts are supposed to be a place where you can let loose and have fun. But she also put a picture of herself grinning at a concert. Anyway, the backlash was very intense. And she deleted her tweet. She definitely posted in good faith, of that I'm sure. But when you're as divisive as she is, and you already are going to get criticised for everything you do, inserting a picture of yourself with an Ariana Grande, I love you, into a massacre is a bad decision. How do you respond to a crisis without having a bad news day? So here's some nice picture of me, like Kim Kardashian.
Someone tweeted yesterday, I don't know who it was, I think it was a comedian, saying, ask yourself, do I need to say anything, and do I need to say it now? And I think that is something we all need to be asking ourselves in the wake of a tragedy, you know, a national incident, particularly when we're so used to having this kind of unboundaried, undammed stream of consciousness that's constantly recorded. A trend that I've noticed that I was particularly sensitive to yesterday, and I found very difficult, is in the wake of a disaster, people will go on Twitter or on social media and say, oh, this awful thing has happened, blood has been shed, people are in turmoil, but let's remember that life is good, and then post a picture of themselves grinning on holiday. Or I actually saw someone yesterday tweet saying, it's hard to remember the good in life today, but it's my wedding anniversary with my husband. And I just thought, just shut up. You know, this is so unhelpful, and it's so reductive, and it's a distillation of everything that's bad about social media. It's so self-obsessed, And I think, you know, I understand wanting to lift spirits and remember the goodness in humanity in the wake of those tragedies. But the goodness in humanity is not like an anniversary with a husband or a new lipstick or you grinning at a concert. That's just fucking irrelevant. And I think there's this great Fred Rogers quote where he said, "When I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, 'Look for the helpers. You'll always find people who are helping.'" And I think that's to illuminate good things that are happening within a crisis. I completely understand the value in that, but I do think it is completely crass and self-obsessed to somehow link it to a personal story of your own happiness or levity on the day.
I think yesterday I tweeted something from the Hilos and from mine, just saying, you know, Manchester, you're in our thoughts and prayers. It kept pretty simple, and I didn't put anything out on social media. And then last night at about midnight, I put up a picture of a friend and I at a party, and I really thought about it. I thought, God, is this really insensitive? And I'm sure some people will think it was, actually, but I did it because my mantra on it is, like you say, don't use it as a springboard to celebrate
exactly
yourself.
Celebrate just yourself entirely separately.
Just exactly.
So like, I've got no problem
so
with
I
that.
So I didn't go, today's been really shitty, but here I am with some fried chicken. I just thought, I've expressed my sentiment. I am, as a sentient human being, devastated by this. But if anyone's going to believe that me going to a work party last night is indicative of me not giving a fuck when terrorists rose up children, then that's not the kind of person I want to be having a civilised conversation
exactly,
with anyway.
But the important thing is that you didn't say, oh, somehow me wearing like a sexy dress, eating fried chicken at a party is going to like make people forget about the barbaric tragedy of
because
yesterday.
Because go me.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, but as I said, can I just also say that I'm sure lots of people didn't think it was correct to put anything out at all. I'm sure some people even thought it wasn't okay for me to put that out last night. I think ultimately it does come down to a personal judgment.
But also the other thing as well, sorry, I had a bit of an outburst about the people doing the whole look at like how great my life
no,
is.
No, I understand.
But,
I understand.
You know, I also understand that I'm sure I have made mistakes and not known how to react to things.
Sensitivity is a minefield, I think, yeah, in knowing how. Do you know what? Maybe this is something we should be grateful for, that we're learning this now.
That's it.
You know, we haven't had.
This is brand new, the internet, you know. This is as in, it's not.
No, but also that terrorism attacks, the awfulness of them, is something that we still don't know how to navigate. And frankly, I'd rather that we had some clunky social media navigation, mm-hmm, than we had become so au fait with terrorist attacks that we knew exactly how to respond.
No,
to them.
And also, it's the, you know, John Ronson really made me rethink when I read all his work about public shaming.
Oh,
you know,
God!
When you're constantly, as I said, doing this public stream
amazing
of consciousness,
book,
of course you're going to get things wrong sometimes, and you're not defined by your mistakes. So, like, you know, we're all learning as we go what the appropriate
but also
way
it's,
is
it's,
to behave in these situations.
It's a consistent tone, I think, with social media. So there's no space, or there's no room or accommodation for nuance and intent. There is no,
yes,
it is seen literally isolated. You can't contextualise, you can't intellectualise. It's just the words on the page. And that's why a lot of kind of quite, you know, jokes that cusp on bad taste are not ones that I would ever put on Twitter.
No.
There was an interesting, I've been watching a lot of, well, as you know, I watch a lot of Good Morning Britain anyway, and it was actually devastating to watch Susanna Reid trying to read it out the next morning, and she just sort of kept breaking down in tears and then being quite furiously embarrassed with herself, like it wasn't her tragedy to mourn. And she's going, I'm so sorry, it doesn't help anyone when I do this. And Kate Garraway just goes, Susanna, look, you know, don't
it's
apologize,
we're all
feeling it. And what they were saying is they were talking to someone, and I'm sorry, I should know who it was, but they were talking to someone and they said, you know, the security threat has now been elevated from severe to critical, as you say. What does that mean for everyone? That's quite terrifying. And the response was, which I found quite soothing, was this happens a lot. You just don't know. You know, the amount that's going on, the amount that's blocked. I remember someone told me that 9 terror attacks that never even reached the public were blocked last year. And last time it was blocked, that I think possibly after the last terror attack we had in the UK, they elevated it to critical just for 5 days.
Well, that's what Jonathan Freeland said in his article.
So it's not going to be for years.
Yeah, he said he anticipates that it won't be like France, by Paris, he said that he thinks it will be short-term.
I mean, none of us really fucking know, do we? You can only hope.
But that's the thing as well, that you have to, you know, it's very difficult to know how to behave in times like this. And as we've said, it's a very sensitive thing to talk about because
it's religion.
It's easy to say, let's go on as we were. But I think everyone woke up feeling different today, you know, and it's the reality is I was thinking today, I was like, well, should I take the tube? Is that something?
You know, weirdly, I took the tube unthinkingly because I felt like Manchester was really far away, which is sheer idiocy on my part because it's not far, it's not removed. But for some really odd reason, I felt different about the Underground than if the attack had been in London.
I felt that I'm a very anxious person anyway with this stuff, and I can let that really colour all my thoughts. And I think the important thing, the whole platitude of carry on as we were, what we must take from that is we mustn't let it colour or taint our view of the Muslim community, and we mustn't allow for knee-jerk racism.
So to end, how can we help? Manchester Evening News have started a Just Giving page that has now raised over 1.1 million in under 2 days to support families of those killed and injured. It's very easy to do. We tweeted the link last night. You can do it via PayPal. There's also a charity called Human Appeal raising money for victims and the victims' families in an appeal called Muslims for Manchester. They are a Muslim faith-based humanitarian aid charity based in Greater Manchester. They help people in need all across the world and here in the UK. We will tweet the link to that page as well. Back to the typical frothy fare of the high low. This is episode 12. What have been your high lows of this week, Dolly? Actually, I'm going to tell you my low, which was being told by everyone I've ever met and everyone I haven't met how hilarious it is that I don't know who's in the Lighthouse family.
I think we've never received more messages than about that one gaffe.
It's odd that people seem to hold that close. I mean, that it can provide that me. Do you know what I mean? I think if I made a mistake about someone in the cause,
people loved it. People loved it. My dad was in the pub talking to my mum about it, and he was like, God, it was funny, Barbara. God, it was the funniest thing I've ever heard.
I mean, Dolly were vaguely insulted. We were like, we've done funnier things.
So surely we've been funnier when we tried to be consciously funny.
I liked We Will Make Breakfast Great Again much more.
I know, that's way funnier.
Anyway, because it was my gaffe.
Give the people what they want.
I know.
Anyway, they loved it.
So apparently much funnier than Frankie Dettori, who, yes, I gather from Twitter, a lot of you don't know who he is. So Dolly is kind of validated by that. So, okay, my week. I have rediscovered eBay in a really big way.
Welcome.
So I was a huge eBay. What's your rating? I bet I've done more transactions than
How many? I can't remember. It's really good, but I've got a really high rating.
Can't remember.
But there's one review. There's one review that I still love that was back from like 2009 where a user said they felt that I'd led them on.
I had a terrible argument once over a £5 postage. I was in a swimming pool. And this argument was raging on and on. I remember just wanting to throw my phone in the pool because this woman from eBay had made me want to end my phone's life.
I thought you were going to say throw yourself in the pool. And I would say panda, or even for you, that's a little bit
dramatic. I was already
dramatic.
In it. I was on my phone in the pool. So I haven't been on eBay that much in the last few years. I was using Etsy or ASOS Marketplace for my vintage steals.
I check eBay every morning.
But as we know, it has got very, very hot. It's got very hot. We love talking about how hot it's got. It's got very hot. And I wanted tea dresses. And I thought, I know what I want. I want Kate Moss for Topshop. And I want it now.
I've got an alert for that.
Well, I bought the red poppy wraparound dress.
Got that one.
And I bought the classic Kate Moss tea dress.
With the yellow flowers?
No, the classic one, the really short one that she wore with black patent ballet pumps.
Oh, I can't remember that one.
Well, you're a heathen then. I don't believe you were ever a fan. But this was particularly nostalgic for me because the Kate Moss for Topshop, there were four collections. Ask me anything, it is my trivia category. So there were four collections of this. And the first one that came up, and I remember the hype was unbelievable. And I was 19... and I was at Leeds University and I set my alarm for 4 a.m. I went alone. I did not need people dragging me down. I went alone and I walked into town. It was a long walk. It was 45 minutes and there were people coming back from the clubs and they were like, where are you going? And I was like, oh, I'm just going to see someone. I'd actually been asleep for 4 hours. I'd set my alarm. I got in the queue, got my wristband, queued till 7 a.m., got in, got 5 tea dresses. And this was at a time when it was less rank to do this than it is now. Kept 1 tea dress, sold the other 4, made myself 400 quid in 2 days.
My God.
Big success. Anyway, they came up quite small and yeah, I accrued 8 dresses from Kate Moss for Topshop that were passed all around my friends. We've all got memories. We've all got pictures of us doing our makeup really badly, wearing our hair really badly in a Kate Moss for Topshop dress. And they just went passed around and passed around. And eventually I ended up with just 1 left. In my cupboard. I even sold the amazing kind of black cage one. So
I love that one. I've got an alert for that one.
Oh, I sold them all.
With the silk by the neck.
So I've rebought these two and they really are the perfect fucking tea dresses.
They're especially incredible. They fit so well.
And especially if you're short, they are, because they are really short.
They're very short. I had to give that red one to my flatmate.
So actually, I've had a good week, so I bought those two. So I feel really happy. I spent £150, which is cheap.
But the joy of eBay is the people who don't know the value of what they have in the back of their
cupboard. And the joy of vintage shopping is occasionally you come across a superlative fit that I would pay way more than that for that red denim skirt. I'll wear it for you next week. With my Gucci belt, okay. It's exceptional. Also this week, I watched the absolutely phenomenal BBC 3-parter, 3 Girls, about the Rochdale paedophile ring. Did you watch that, Dol?
Yeah, I watched it in one sitting.
Did you not think it was, like, it took my breath away? Mm. I tried to tweet about it, and I just tweeted, oh my God, Maxine Peake, goddess, these women, these girls, this what the BBC has done. And I noticed that I was not one of the only people who was desperate to somehow say something, but just couldn't kind of formulate words. There were other journalists who were just like, oh God, this is amazing.
It was deeply affecting, and it's the performances.
British telly at its like absolute best.
Completely. It was the performances of the girls, particularly the girl who played Ruby, that I found,
oh my God, Ruby,
very, very moving. I mean, you felt like you were straying into like an observational dock at some point.
Paul Kay as Holly's father was also, sorry sweetie, Paul Kay as Holly's father I thought was also very, very affecting to watch. Mm. He did an amazing job, I thought, in that of viewing his little girl as viewing his daughter as by turns a little girl and by other turns as someone highly sexual that he didn't understand or know.
Yeah, and it was very disturbing, I think.
Actually, that's not right at all. She's not highly sexual. Someone that had become highly sexualised.
Yeah. Well, there's that line in it, isn't there, when Maxine Peake's character, Sarah Rebotham, says, there's no such thing as a child prostitute, only a child that's being abused. Apparently, Maxine Peake, I read afterwards, had went to spend a lot of time with Sarah Rebotham to really kind of... And she said the minute that she went in to meet her, she said, I love this woman, and she knew that she could capture who she was. And did you see that she was the real Sarah Rebotham was on First Dates last night?
No!
Yeah.
I didn't!
Yeah, and people are calling now that she be publicly rewarded for her work.
She bloody well should.
Crime.
She was, this is a sort of clunky comparison, but she is like the Erin Brockovich of...
She's a whistleblower.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Did you see at the end as well, when at the credits, slowly all these different names of where child paedophile gangs had been uncovered in the UK, and it amounted to about 60 different places.
Mm.
Absolutely.
It's a very disturbing but very powerful...
Equally
watch.
Troubling and powerful is the essay in The Atlantic that has been doing the rounds that we tweeted off our Instagram that both Dolly and I were knocked sideways by. It is called My Family Slave and it's by Alex Tizon.
It's the perfect long read. It's the most beautifully constructed, powerful story.
It's very powerful, and it is about a writer who was born in the Philippines and moved to America at a young age with his 3 siblings and his mother and his father. And with them they bought who he believed at that age to be his nanny. It transpired as he becomes older that she is the family's slave. She's not paid. She's not given any time off. She sleeps in corners. She's not allowed to go back to the Philippines.
And she spent her entire life working as their slave.
Yeah, since she was, what, 14?
As his mother's
slave, and I don't want to give too much of it away because some of the most shocking things about it are some of the most beautifully written bits.
Yeah.
Alex died the day after his essay came out on the cover of The Atlantic. And The Atlantic released a statement saying, you know, this essay is only out because the family of Alex were so kind and helpful in allowing us to publish this posthumously. But there's been a backlash, which I kind of feel really annoyed.
Been a backlash?
I feel really annoyed when there's a backlash like this, when someone's done something really they've made themselves very vulnerable, they've admitted
and
that they're culpable.
He completely admits his culpability.
And also he's a very interesting voice to the conversation of how of slavery in the Philippines, how it's viewed then, how it's even viewed now.
And the very complex, I had no idea about, tier system in which one used to acquire slaves.
I mean, the backlash is, he's really guilty, he should be punished. And it's like, well, he's died, so well done for doing all your reading.
But also, it's a story of trying to atone for his family's sins as well. And if you don't understand that in the intention, then you just haven't read it properly, I don't think.
It's a brilliant, brilliant essay. It is on our Twitter.
It's about 20 minutes to read. I would really take 20 minutes.
We're also going to start doing some podcasts that I love do this. So we're going to start putting in the bio each week. You just click to see more on iTunes, wherever you're listening. In the bio each week, we're going to list the articles, books, TV shows, anything that we've talked about that we've been enjoying that week, because we get asked a lot.
And I don't want to sound impatient. If you still can't find them after that, you're still tweeting us saying, where can you find the links? I will get angry.
But also, we have a Goodreads account as well.
Yes.
We have set up our Goodreads account. I think the thing we forget is that a lot of people who listen to the podcast
don't
follow us on Twitter, which is a goddamn shame, because we are finer than a fine wine. And we tweet a lot of stuff that we love there, which is why perhaps we neglect elsewhere. So that's why we'll start putting in our bio all of the kind of cultural signposting, whatever wanky way you want to say that we do. But our Goodreads account, it's literally, if you just look for The Hilo, we've registered as The Hilo, and we have
put, I think we're The Hilo Show, actually.
Hilo Show, yeah. And we've put all of the books that we have loved, all that are on our, that we're currently reading, and all that are on our shelf to be read, and we will update that as much as we can. If you're like, why has the shelf not moved for 2 weeks? It's because we've been busy and we're not reading as much as we'd like to. I am actually reading a completely wonderful book at the moment, an advanced copy of the journalist Elizabeth Day's book, which is out in July, called The Party, and I'm gulping it down, and I can't wait to lend it to you, Dolly.
Do you know what I'm reading now?
What are you reading?
Nothing.
You know why?
Because I'm writing a book?
Because I'm watching Downton Abbey.
Oh my God, still!
India staged an intervention yesterday. She said, it's got to stop.
The more anxious
what
I get...
What series do you want?
Oh, I've only got two left, Panda.
Two series?
Did you not get my video last night of me saying I'm running out?
No, I didn't watch it.
India said, stop sending me videos of you watching Downton Abbey. The closer my deadline for my book comes, the more anxious I get, and the more I need to run into the arms of 1920s England.
If you could buy cast members of Downton Abbey like you can of So Solo Crew for a party, would you buy them?
Miss Patmore.
For them to come and talk you to sleep in your room?
Yeah, I would, yeah. I'd get Mrs. Patmore.
Okay, so for Mrs. Patmore, from writing your book, have you got any other highlights from the week?
Well, I've been at home for the last week, getting some writing done. I was in Gloucestershire. I had such a dreamy time. I kept going on all these lovely long walks and runs.
And
then
kept tweeting on Twitter.
I just listened to back-to-back old Desert Island Discs episodes. God, I listened to Diana Atthill's. Have you ever listened to hers?
No, I want to.
I posted it on the Hilo's account. It's a wonderful tale of a woman who was a hopeless romantic in her youth and how she became a much more contented pragmatist on the outlook of love. And it was just, I just had the loveliest time. I had a real moment where I was picking some wild garlic in my mum's garden to make some wild garlic pesto, and I just thought, I will be ready for retirement one day. Do you ever have those moments?
All the time. When I'm lying in the bath reading my book.
Mm.
When
you're like, come at me, it's fine.
When I'm deep cleaning the saucepans.
How do you deep clean them?
You really put some welly into it. You get tennis elbow. That's when you know you've really cleaned the saucepans. Ollie does not really clean the saucepans.
I also went to a wedding for my friends Meg and Henry. And it was quite awe-inspiring because Meg is a candidate in the general election.
Wow.
So not only has she literally went from her wedding to back to campaigning up in Birmingham this week, which is just like amazing that she managed to pull together a wedding
you know, while all this is happening. So
what party is she?
She's Conservative. So we're different politically, but I have nothing but admiration for her hard work. And she's, you know, we're not all that different, actually, morally, where we, you know, cross on things. And that's where I think I don't want to be one of those Tory bashing liberals, because I'm friends with a lot of them. And she's just a very inspiring person, I think. But anyway, so the highlight of the wedding for me, other than obviously watching them make beautiful vows to each other, is I started a conga line on the dance floor that was so successful, Pandora, that it came to a standstill.
Because everyone joins.
Oh my God, it was joined. Like snake. You know, exactly. When snake eats itself.
That's what happened. It, like, there was nowhere for it to go in the marquee.
So that was my highlight of the last week, was starting my most successful conga line to date.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now time for the top line.
This is the third week of running our new segment, where one of us reads 10 pieces of news in 90 seconds with a crescendo of a sound effect that may sound a bit like we stole it from Countdown, but only if you listen very carefully. So, Pandora, hit me with the top line.
God, I'm already sweating my tits off. This is the Hilo's top line. A teenager in Mexico called Julian Rios Cantu has developed a prototype bra that could detect breast cancer through thermal sensors. Wow. The teenager now has 15 employees but is still in high school. The bra will be available in Europe next year. Clint Eastwood said, "We have lost our cultural sense of humour." Speaking from the Cannes Film Festival, he said, "We're in this era where everyone thinks it's politically incorrect. We're killing ourselves. We've lost our sense of humour." A man with a knife has been arrested outside Buckingham Palace on Wednesday. Police do not think it is terrorist-related. His identity has not yet been revealed, but no one was injured. Former Bond actor Sir Roger Moore has died, aged 89. A 21-year-old waitress has been fired from Chilton Firehouse for enjoying a sexathon with Orlando Bloom. Orlando has since apologised to Viviana Ross on behalf of his penis. Julian Assange has said he will remain inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London in order to avoid extradition to the United States, despite being told he no longer faces a sex investigation by the Swedish authorities. The non-royal royal wedding, said to cost $1 million, took place in a giant greenhouse, and the bride wore Giles. Much has been made of the best man speech, where Justin Johansson likened Pippa to a loyal dog. Stop press. M&S are adding bananas to their fruit salad. Bananas are the most wasted fruit, with 160 million bananas thrown away each year due to browning. M&S have developed a new process to slow the browning. A couple dubbed the Richard and Judy of local radio had sex in front of schoolboys in the woodland and encouraged them to come and have a play, reports the Telegraph. Former BBC broadcaster Julie Wadsworth, 60, is alleged to have worn a split skirt and no knickers as she had sexual activity with her 69-year-old husband Tony in full view of youngsters. Brandon Vesmar from Texas is suing a woman for $17. This is the best one. $17 after she texted during their movie date. "It was the first date from hell," he said, not at all dramatically. It is his pet peeve.
This is the Hilo, and that was the top line. That was a good little selection, Pandora. I enjoyed those.
Anything you'd like to discuss?
I would like to discuss...
Orlando Bloom's sexathon, you filthy animal.
No, I'd actually like to discuss... Kate Middleton's outfit at Pippa's wedding.
I think everyone thinks that we're going to talk about the non-royal royal wedding as one of our topics, and we are not, because we don't really have anything to say.
No, but all I will say is, first of all, I friggin' loved that greenhouse idea. And second,
how hot, Dolly.
I did think it must
Dolly,
be very
you would
hot.
Be sweating. You'd melt.
It's so beautiful. I love that whole Victorian conservatory
You'd absolutely
thing.
Melt. Do you know what I also liked is how incredibly stupid a lot of people seem to be. They kept referring to Prince Harry as Pippa Middleton's sister-in-law. They're not sister-in-law. Kate Middleton is his sister-in-law.
Didn't you love her outfit, Kate Middleton?
Honestly, I didn't. I have not looked.
Oh, the tables have turned.
Why?
because I can't believe I'm telling you about what a celebrity was wearing.
No, I saw what she was wearing. It was nudie. She's very pretty.
It looked like a kind of Ozzy Clark floaty thing.
Oh, that's why you liked it.
I just loved it. And I looked at it and I thought, that is like... Because I've never really loved Kate Middleton's style. And I thought, that is perfect peak Kate Middleton. She can wear that all the time. It looked so elegant and lovely.
Someone will have made it for her.
Imagine, yeah, I couldn't like, find like the design. I couldn't see who it was by.
Googling that instead of writing your book.
Literally anything. Also, I loved Grace Dent did a very funny piece that we tweeted on our, on the Hilo's account about middle-class bridezillas ruining your life. And she said one of the details that she loved is that Spencer Matthews, apparently in The Surface, read a passage from The Alchemist.
Oh, my God. No, the only thing that I'm particularly obsessed with is how James Matthews, the groom, and Pippa live in a house in like Little Bolton's or Belgravia or somewhere worth 17 million and he's 37 years old. I want to know how the motherfucking fuck he made 17 million, how I can make 17 million. Clearly, it's not all from his family. Otherwise, Spencer Matthews wouldn't be on Made in Chelsea, Ski the Slope, Dive the Dive, Wank the Wank.
Their father doesn't believe, all credit him. Their
so
father
how the
doesn't
fuck
believe
is he
in
37 living
money?
In a 17 million pound house? Roger me
I
that.
Think he's an
Riddle me that. Not Roger. No, Roger. Roger can stay out of this.
Roger is a verb, is a very different thing.
Roger me and riddle that.
Also, I've always wondered who the eponymous Roger was that shagging was named
it's probably
after.
Roger Moore, R.I.P.
Oh, circling back nicely.
On to a slightly heavier topic. Anyone who follows me on Instagram or Twitter might be familiar, or they might be familiar with this story independently because it certainly had a huge reach. A 20-year-old Danish model called Ulrika Hoyer, who is not a household name, but she is a very successful model. She's the face of Chloe. She's worked for big brands like Celine. And she Instagrammed a picture of herself with the story that she had been fired from the Louis Vuitton show in Kyoto in Japan for being too bloated. Anyway, she tells the story at great length of when she went to the fitting and how she's fired and how she's sent home. And just for clarification, she is 5'10" and she weighs 7.5 stone. And she was told that she is too fat.
So much respect for her, I think, for coming out and saying this. I read an interview with her somewhere, maybe it was your interview, Panda, where she said, I may lose my job for doing this, but you know, that may be the last job I ever did, but I don't care.
She said, this might be my last ever job, but I don't want to work like this anymore. Because I interviewed her and a small segment of the interview appeared in the Times, but I put a lot of the kind of outtakes in the comment section of my Instagram because she was so interesting. And a casting director called James Scully, who has become known as a massive whistleblower, he called out two casting directors for Balenciaga after they treated their models in kind of subhuman conditions and they got fired from Balenciaga. He is so brave and passionate about fair conditions for models. He was also incredibly interesting about our view of models full stop, because one, I'm not going to give too much context, but one man who was perhaps relevant to the piece I wrote said to me, yeah, but what's the new story in this? All models are anorexic, right? And that is exactly what is so fucking wrong. These models do not start anorexic. Some of them might, but a lot of them start age 15 before they've gone through puberty. They then go through puberty age 18 and their body changes. That, at the encouragement of casting directors or model agents or designers, or, you know, it's a whole process. That is something that then can become encouraged by then. And as James said, eating disorders have not always been endemic in this industry. He said, when I started in 1983, it was not a thing. I started when Cindy and Christy and Linda and Naomi were coming up and not one of them had an eating disorder. And they would have told us to fuck off if we, you know, had said that. And he said, that's why Instagram influencers are doing so well now, because they have, and the Instagram girls, the Victoria's Secret Angels, they have that still very slim, but athletic. They don't look ill, these girls. They have that athletic body type of those kind of Amazonian models. And that's what the public wants to see. It's been proved. My friend Lou Stoppard, who's an editor and a curator, she said time and time again, studies have proved that an underweight 17-year-old does nothing for the consumer. So why is this still perpetuated? The modelling industry will always be aspirational, but how do we divorce aspiration from mega skinniness? And how... Also, I would like to say, how do we respond to size across the board? Because I had several people commenting on my Instagram, and I didn't reply to any of it, telling me that I couldn't write the piece, I shouldn't be writing the piece, or I'm a hypocrite because I am slim. And
that to me was an extraordinary thing.
Trust
to write.
Me, Matt, you come up against this a lot and it drives
but
me
But I also
really...
thought, is it better if I'm slim, having never had, genuinely, if I had had one, I would say, I've never had an eating disorder in my life. There is nothing unhealthy about me. I'm a size 8 to a 10. I'm 5'4". I'm, you know, slim but completely healthy. Is it better if I am slim and don't write a piece about stuff I believe in that needs to change? Or is it better that I'm slim and I do write a piece that resonates about stuff that needs to change? Like, pick whatever you think's right. And if you pick the former, then you're a twat, to be honest. So.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's what's difficult as you dive into these industry problems. And I'd like your take on this, is that I just feel like in the fashion industry, there's this endless passing of the buck where
yes.
agents say it's not them, casting directors say it's not them,
yeah.
fashion editors, Alexandra Shulman famously says it's not her. You know, who is it then? And I think it annoys me because the fashion industry isn't governed by this sort of omnipotent, godlike force that no one can capture or no one can reason with.
They make clothes, it seem like so.
They do. Clothes don't appear. Sample sizes don't appear just like a natural disaster. And it's like, oh, well.
So true.
But who, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, there must be someone or something perpetuating this.
Well, Ulrika said, so James said in the 80s it used to be that the dress fit the girl. You know, you made the dress look great on the girl. Ulrika said, you now fit the girl to the dress. So if you have a size 0 dress sample and the girl is too small, no problem. They make it smaller. She's not a problem. If you have a size 0 dress and the girl is too big, the girl is the problem, not the dress.
So it's the designer.
There's a shift. Like you say, everyone passed the buck. I don't know, at Louis Vuitton, they haven't made a comment. I mean, Paris has regulations about weight and BMI, which is body mass index, and all sorts of things like that. I think people will cheat to get around it. I know that James is hoping to come up with some sort of
regulation.
Regulation.
It's so damaging on three counts. It's damaging to the individual herself, for the model herself or himself. And then there's also the damage done on public consciousness and what we deem attractive and what we conflate with aspirational. But there are also the girls who emulate it. And this is something that's I feel very strongly about because it personally affected me. You know, there was 2 years of my life where I just didn't eat. And I was the person who, fine, the fashion industry didn't start that. And I don't want all the blame to be loaded on the fashion industry for girls' eating disorders. You know, it's a commonly held theory from eating disorder experts that it's a very complex disease and it's not as simple as girls looking at magazines and saying, I want to be like her. But I do think it's a disease that is perpetuated and exacerbated by that culture. And I was, you know, I'm ashamed to admit it now, I was that girl who was on Pro Anna websites. And do you know what was on those websites? Pictures of those girls. And the thing that she says is, she says she keeps seeing over and over again these girls that she said, I don't know how they're standing, I don't know how they're functioning.
Their skin changes colour, she said.
And, you know, the reality of what not eating for a long period of time or dramatically reducing your nutrients or calorific intake, it's not pretty, you know. And it has, speaking to someone who's, you know, still has knock-on effects for a long time afterwards, even if you recover. And it affects your digestion, it affects your fertility. It's so serious. It's so serious.
I think we have problems with all sizes, because this is also interestingly the week that there was a new stat that 63% of British adults are overweight. And I read this brilliant article, which again I tweeted on the Hilo's Twitter, from this health expert saying that the way that the narrative around obesity has got to change. You know, shaming doesn't work, especially given that this is often an economic issue. It's a class issue. It's not that it's poor people are thin and rich people are fat like it used to be. You know, it is generally a situation that has become reversed. And I actually think that how polarised it has become, that there are people that you have fat shaming, and then at the other end of the scale, also this kind of fetishization, but also untempered criticism for people that are thin. I don't think the way for us to get healthy models is to tell fat people they're disgusting because, you know, everyone's got different fucking metabolisms, as this doctor said. Until we figure out how metabolisms work, until they work out how metabolism works, you can't give any blanket advice because, you know, I could eat something and you could eat something and it could affect our bodies in completely different ways. But on the flip side, I feel like this is something that is also happening at the other side. And like you say, this, you know, this is not the first time that I have been called a hypocrite for inhabiting my natural body. I've been the same shape for 15 years. My weight has changed by about 3 pounds, give or take either side, you know? So it's more a conversation that needs to happen around size, full stop, I think, and that the emphasis should not so much be on the silhouette, but on the health.
Completely.
Someone could be a size 8 and look very healthy, you know, not bony, not underweight, not gaunt. Someone else could be a size 8 and look perfectly ill.
But also, look, I've been overweight. I've been overweight, and I've been someone who that has been a problem for them as well. When I had, you know, big problems with anxiety and emotional eating, and let me tell you, it was just as fucking hard. It was just as hard having that as a problem as it was not eating.
The funny thing is being slim myself, people often say stuff to me as if we're co-conspirators, thinking that I'll be like, oh yeah, fat people, lazy or whatever. What a lot of people don't realise is that I'm from a family that massively struggles with their weight. I'm the only person in my family that hasn't had real
struggles
with being overweight, and that means that I really have seen this issue in a different way to you, but I have seen it in both sides. I have witnessed it firsthand my whole life that when you're a size 18, you can't shop on the high street. That, you know, you're conscious of eating too much in public because people will think you're a greedy bitch, whereas there's something kind of adorable about someone skinny eating a donut. It's a conversation that I think, I mean, in the issues of time, we won't carry on, but it's a conversation we could both talk a lot more on. But I think Ulrika is a whistleblower and that conversation needs to be had, but it is part of a much bigger conversation, I think, about size.
Here's something we never thought we'd be discussing on our podcast, and proof that it really is a veritable mixed bag
the
with
most
something
mixed
for
of
everyone.
Bags.
Shares nipple pasties. Is it pasties or pasties?
It's pasties.
Good to have some clarification there. So for anyone who missed the story, the Sun reports, Cher stunned fans at the Billboard Music Awards by performing in a raunchy silver stage costume, which left little to the imagination. The pop veteran, 71, wore nipple pasties. Under a barely there Diamante dress for her turn on stage at the prize giving, and wowed as she performed her hit track Believe in the skimpy outfit. So guess you had something to say on this, Pandora. It's the man whose name we do not mention on the podcast anymore. He's like the Voldemort of the high-low. But that man said on Good Morning Britain, come on, Cher, for goodness sake, love. She's a grandmother. For goodness sake, put it away. Grow old gracefully.
Firstly, I have an image of you now going to a Delice de Pan or whatever they're called, Delice de France, saying, I'd like a nipple pasty, my good man.
There's no danger.
Oh,
of that
the
happening.
Thought of a nipple pasty. Oof, makes
have
my boobs
hurt.
Pasties.
Have you worn them?
Yeah,
pasties?
The thing is, like, you can see through. You can see them through. I'd almost rather see the nipple than see the, like, silicone.
Why have you worn them to stop nipples poking out?
I've worn them where I'm wearing a dress when you can't wear a bra. And actually, I have seen a new light to them last night when I was wearing a dress without a bra, is that you really chafe your nipples.
Yeah.
But I actually find them quite painful to wear as well.
Why are they painful?
Because when you pull them off, it's like your nipple wants to come with it.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah, it's like pulling a plaster off your nip. So what this comes down to, so the debate that rages on, is age and sexuality and the relationship betwixt the two. So women including Madonna and Helen Mirren have spoken at length about this. And actually, when I interviewed the actress Jennifer Connelly, I think it was last year, she spoke about turning 40 and that her roles had become more binary. So she had kind of aged 10 years overnight. And it's a bit like that whole idea of the Madonna and the whore, except with age and sexuality, it's like Snow White and the witch. I don't know if I've mixed my fairy tales there. But, and then Helen Mirren said something really interesting in 2015. She said, I always think of this scientific survey carried out amongst American college kids in the 60s. They were all happy to talk about their own sex life. Then they were asked about their parents' sex life and, oh God, they were horrified. The young always want to feel as if they're the ones to do everything first. But naturally, it's been done before. I love that.
Well, this has always angered me, the way, particularly in this country, I think, the way that women are told that they are, after the age of 40 or 50, basically invisible.
I think America's worse. Hollywood's worse.
I think England is particularly ageist. I think it's a particular problem here. I think, you know, you can't dress a certain way, you can't be sexual, you can't drink, you can't be dirty, you can't be badly behaved. You know, you're expected basically to put on a cardigan and shuffle off to fucking Bournemouth and just sit eating Werther's originals and watching daytime TV.
To all our listeners in Bournemouth, Donna says it with affection.
And I think it angers me more as I get older, because the inevitability of that invisibility becomes... It, you know, it's coming for all of us. You know, there was a time where I thought I'd be
young and hot forever,
wearing a crop top, for, you know, jumping around and being cute at the bar to get free drinks forever. But I'm very aware that that is going to run out. And it's difficult when we're in this society where women are told constantly to condition themselves for this male gaze and this approval. And then you hit 40 and not only is that completely taken from you, but you're also told you're not really interesting, you don't have stuff to say, you're a boring old dear. And I think... there's something that really affected me. I talk about this a lot, but it's the most powerful play I ever saw. It was a play called Linda at the Royal Court a couple of years ago, written by Penelope Skinner. And you can actually, you can buy the play now, and it's really worth reading. And it had a very profound effect on me, that examined how a woman getting older and how society viewed her differently. And there's this one line in it that I always think of, where she says, when I was younger and I'd go to car mechanics and I didn't understand how my car worked, they thought I was adorable and flirted with me. Now when I go, they roll their eyes.
God, amazing. Amazing encapsulation.
Like, yeah.
What do you think of the school of thought that says that Cher wearing pasties, or, you know, a 70-year-old in hot pants, can't think of a 70-year-old off the top of my head. Oh, you know, who's that Baddie Winkle, that granny who wears hot pants. What do you make of the whole idea that they are a triumph for older women and that they are championing?
I think they are. Because I don't think that what they're... it's not that this is the model, this is the bastion of what older female sexuality should be. But I think, first of all, the thing is with Cher that people forget is that this is... she has all... this is a part of her identity, this sexuality. That sort of wigs and glitter, that ostentation has always been a part of who she is. And why should she abandon that now? And I think... in my feminism, it's something I really tussle with, about whether sexuality for a woman can ever be used as an empowering thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. I expect they're right, but for me, it's not necessarily...
I think it's case by case. And I think in Cher's case, the woman is a renowned and respected actor and artist. She's a musician. She's a philanthropist. She's an outspoken liberal. Her sexuality doesn't define her. It's certainly not just for the male gaze. And it's one facet of her identity. And fucking good on her for saying, no, I'm not going to shuffle away and hide that because it might cause you offence.
I don't like the way fancying an older woman is seen as alternative. Like, I kind of feel like I see and hear a lot of young men say that they really fancy Helen Mirren to try and sound like subversive, or worse, like they're sort of some really cool feminist. It's like, do you actually fancy her or them, or is it just so kind of farcical that you think you'll sound really alt? And it shouldn't be alt. It's not like it's weird to fancy Brad Bloody Pitt, who's 50.
No, or also, lest we forget Iggy Pop, who is the same age as Cher, who has
like
not
shoe.
Had a top on in 10 years, and I'm sure Piers Morgan wouldn't have been offended by that.
He has not had a top on in 10 years, Mr. Bates.
It's time for Ask the Hilo. We, because of a rather top-heavy but vital opening segment, we only have time for one question today, but we've got some amazing other questions, which we promise... it's just getting longer and longer, this bloody show. We keep saying, let's do a really long... like today, we said, let's do a really long question time. And then here we are, an hour and a half later, both dripping in sweat.
I'm so hot.
You get to go home now. I have to go on and talk to people, and they're going to be like... wow, have you just bathed in your own stink? Anyway, so here's a question. Hello, Dolly and Pandora. 2 years ago, I got engaged to my boyfriend, who I was completely in love with. He was my best friend. He made me happier than I've ever been. But for some reason, during the course of our engagement, I invented problems. I worried constantly about all the things that could prove problematic in our future. He was so wonderful and supportive that he helped me seek medical help and looked into a therapist for me to see. Despite all this, I somehow managed to mess everything up. We called off our wedding 3 months before it was meant to go ahead. It's been 2 years now, and I'm still not over it. I miss him every day. I want him more than anything, but he's been very clear that he doesn't want me back. He says he can't go back to how he felt. Do you think there's anything I can possibly do to convince him that I'll love him forever and I can make him happy? Or is it a lost cause? Please help. Oh, God, that was very devastating to read. I feel for you so much.
Panda messaged me and said you were welling up when you read it.
I just can't even imagine what it must feel like to desperately love someone that you've lost because of involuntary mind activities. You know, the mind is a... From what it sounds like, you are obviously very, very vulnerable and perhaps struggling with mental health issues. And I think that's what's so devastating, is it clouded your love for him, which was never in any doubt. But I can understand why for him it was too much to bear.
I'm going to say something I think she might find quite difficult to hear, but it's something that someone said to me. This was a very difficult thing that a professional said to me once, and it was hard for me to hear. No one on this planet owes you your happiness other than you. In your longer letter, you say that you're someone who overthinks and who's very anxious. There may be a possibility that this is the great love of your life and you've lost him. I would say what could be more likely is that if you're someone who is feeling unsettled or anxious or distressed, that in your head you have conflated him with your happiness.
And oh yeah, that's very true.
If I were you, I would maybe look a little deeper at what might be missing there, because whatever, that void might be him, but the void might be deeper and no man will ever be able to fill that. And if I were you, if you can afford it, I would try and make it a financial priority to keep going to therapy. That's what I would say. And then you might get more clarity on it after that.
I think, for what it's worth, on whether or not you'll get him back, I feel like I have witnessed people go back to once destructive situations and make them constructive and have a future. But it's difficult.
Couples go to the edge of darkness and back.
They do, but I don't have many who manage to make it work long term. I would say that the odds are against you. And I'm not saying that to say give up, stop loving him, but that having gone through what it sounds like you've gone through, if my husband had called off the wedding 3 months, even if it was because I knew he was going through inner turmoil, I don't know if my heart could take that again. So what you must, I know it's not really a balm to soothe you, but what you must think is, think of his position. He just can't put himself there. He just can't do it. And sometimes in life, I think there's that really, really devastating realisation that love is not enough. Who's to say that he doesn't still love you? But it's just an impossible situation, perhaps.
And the other thing to remember as well, and again, I don't want to sound like I'm being too cruelly pragmatic, because I understand what it feels like, you know, to feel that love for someone and how awful it feels when you feel like you've lost it and somehow you're to blame. I don't think you are. I think don't underestimate your feelings at that time. They wouldn't have come from completely nowhere. But the other thing is that I remember breaking up a relationship when I was young, and he was like a big love of my life. And I said to my mum, what if I regret this? And she said, you might.
Did you?
Yeah. No, I didn't. I did. Well, I don't know. Maybe I will. Maybe at 60 I will. That's what, you know, love is a risk. And if you get to a point where you break up with someone and you're like, ugh, oh, I'll never regret that, then it means you really let the relationship rumble on for too long anyway.
I've been absolutely devastated by everyone I broke up with, and I can categorically tell you that I would have been a terrible disaster if I'd married any of them.
Well, there we go. That's a tale of hope for you there. But we're sending you love, and we hope that
you find some inner peace on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
And perhaps find someone else to love if it's not to be with him. Thank you very much to everyone who listened to episode 12 of The High Low. We are having a week off next week because Dolly has a big book deadline. We won't talk about it too much, or she sweats even
because Dolly's
more.
Got to watch the last two series of Downton.
No, there is a genuine reason. I wouldn't let her win with that one. So we have a week off next week. We will be back the week after. Please don't forget to tweet us at The High Low Show or email us thehighlowshow@gmail.com. Thank you very much to Acast, our wonderful podcast platform, for letting us record in your charming but ultimately sweatboxy of a studio. It is very kind.
And thank you to Lauren Benstead for the funky jingle.
Bye-bye.
Bye.